How does this sound?
It sounds like you're far away.
Toby!
Brandon.
Toby, yeah, okay, let's do that.
Come back to the mothership.
And then I'll just do more like Ancient Phalians, and then I'll come in like I'm coming in for a landing. I can see how excited you are.
Since the dawn of 2009, one TV show has dared to ask the most important questions about the origins of our world. That show is Ancient Aliens.
Yet until now, no one has asked the biggest question of all. Is Ancient Aliens total bullshit?
And that's what our show's about. Finding the truth under the nonsense of one of television's most popular franchises.
This is...
more like Ancient Aliens. Toby.
Yes, Brandon, that was really good.
Toby. Coming in, Toby.
Board the mothership, Brandon.
Toby, I've made some mistakes, but now I think I'm correcting my trajectory. Toby.
Wow.
Toby.
Oh, you know what? You can't even hear me because you don't have your headphones on.
Toby.
This is going to be a real surprise for you when you listen to the recording.
Tranquility Base here.
All right.
The Beagle has landed.
You're here. All right. You know,
Toby, that was special effects.
It was like 1930s era.
Mm-hmm.
You should have had some, cornmeal or whatever that they crunch to make it sound like you're walking through snow.
Oh, very cool. Yeah. Weimar Republic era filmmaking, a la Metropolis or something.
Oh, there we go. Yeah.
Really good stuff. Well.
Yep. There you go. You're tying it right into the episode right off the bat.
Thank you very much.
All right. Very clever.
Get us into it.
All right, I'm Toby Ball, the creator and host of the UFO podcast, Strange Arrivals.
I'm Brandon R. Reynolds, journalist, low-budget space explorer, and questioner of all the things that may or may not actually be connected to the Nazis.
Your introduction changes every single episode, and mine stays the same.
Well, that's kind of how we are, Toby.
That's how it goes. All right, Brandon, it's just the two of us mm-hmm. this time?
Yeah, this is a... solo episode, or a duet episode, I guess.
Duet?
Yeah.
I was trying to think of what sort of musical duo I could compare us to.
Hall & Oates.
You're thinking, oh, Hall & Oates, you came right up with that. Yeah. I was like the Everly Brothers, mm-hmm. but they kind of hated each other.
Yeah.
Simon & Garfunkel,
mm-hmm.
Salt mm-hmm. & Peppa.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah. So anyway, just the two of us, lean and mean. Today we are looking at the episode... NASA's Secret Agenda, which is the second episode of season 10, and it originally aired on July 31st, 2015. And you know what else happened on July 31st, 2015?
Not specifically.
All right. That's the same day that Rowdy Roddy Piper died.
Oh, no. R.I.P. Truly yeah. a legend.
In the not necessarily ancient, but definitely alien classic, They Live.
They Live. Hell yeah.
Have you seen that?
Yes. John Carpenter.
Great flick. Great flick.
Yeah.
All right.
Best fight scene in history.
Oh, remind me.
Oh, it's the one that goes on for like 10 or 15 minutes, it seems like, between him and his partner. He's trying to get his friend to put on the glasses that reveal aliens.
Yeah.
And his friend doesn't want to do it.
Hey, you better find yourself someplace to hide and keep praying nobody ever finds you.
Try these on.
Look, you crazy mother.
Put these on.
Hey! Stay away from me.
I'm telling you, you dumb son of a...
And so they proceed to get into a pro wrestling style fight in the middle of an alley. Okay, and they just beat the hell out of each other. And eventually, spoiler alert, he does put on the glasses. And he finds out that everybody's a creepy alien.
Yeah. Or at least the rich people. So RIP to Rowdy Roddy Piper. So I don't know what you thought before we get started. This is the first episode of Ancient Aliens that I found sort of genuinely disappointing.
Wow, it took this long.
Maybe we can talk a little bit later about what makes an Ancient Aliens episode good versus a bad Ancient Aliens episode. Because this definitely seemed bad, and I kept waiting for it to get better, and it just kind of never did.
Yeah. Well, it was taking a pretty big bite of history, and a lot of it was very well trod. So, you know, very quickly, it was basically the abbreviated life story of Werner von Braun, who, you know, was a prodigy in Germany, grew up and headed up the German rocket program into World War II, was a Nazi, We'll talk about how much of a Nazi he was, what he knew when, and then was recruited by the United States, headed up NASA's program, and then did some stuff with Walt Disney. I mean, it's a real 20th century life.
Yes. All right. Wernher von Braun, not an alien, according to this. Why are we covering this episode? Well, it takes the remarkable story of the space program and kind of reduces it to alien influence. And the thesis, as far as I could tell, was physics?
Yeah.
What the hell are you talking about?
Yeah. I'm glad we're doing this episode so early in our season because we are now being introduced to a new but very common species of ancient alien episode. So, you know, heretofore, the general thesis has been ancient civilizations weren't smart enough to do the amazing stuff that they had done. Therefore, they must have had help from beings from beyond the stars. In this one, you're taking a look at the life of a modern genius and saying what he knew he couldn't have known on his own. And so you'll see this in other episodes that we'll get into at some point, I'm sure. Same thing happens with Einstein and some others. So there's a whole category of like geniuses aren't really geniuses. They're just guys who are basically antennae for alien influence. And so there's the cynicism isn't just about these ancient peoples, but it's also about, you know, modern stuff. It's basically saying humans can't really do anything on their own. Every great moment, every great leap forward, we had training wheels, and those training wheels came in UFOs.
Humans can't do anything is basically what it comes down to. Mm-hmm. All right, just jumping into the episode, we start off mostly talking about Wernher von Braun with the question, might aliens have influenced von Braun? He apparently believed humanity's future was in space, which would indicate that he must have been actually in touch with aliens or receiving signals from aliens. It jumps from there, before we get into like his sort of biography, which comes up in just a second. They talk about the 1950s when von Braun teamed up with Walt Disney, noted anti-Semite Walt Disney, to make three films about sending people into space. So at this point, you've got a guy who we'll find out in a minute is a former SS agent and a noted anti-Semite getting together to make films, which are kind of hilariously very 1950s, the couple of clips you see, about sending into people's space and how it's desirable and how we might do it.
Von Braun boldly predicted not only how we would send men into space, but also the use of protective suits, lunar landing vehicles, orbiting space stations, and even manned trips to Mars.
If we were to start today on an organized and well-supported space program, I believe a practical passenger rocket could be built and tested within 10 years.
Yeah, Disney shows up in such fascinating ways. I mean, I haven't seen it in there, but it would not surprise me if there was an Ancient Aliens episode that focused on Walt Disney. How did this man come up with the idea of a talking mouse? And how did he build that into an entertainment empire? Must have been aliens, Toby.
Well, he's trying to get us used to strange creatures who can talk and walk around with pants on. That's right. And stuff. So von Braun was born in Prussia to wealthy parents. By age 3 or 4, it was obvious that he was gifted. You know, they talk a little bit about German science fiction that was around during his youth, sort of in pulps. It was sort of like a utopian pulp genre of books and magazines. And then they also point out movies like particularly Metropolis, which is Fritz Lang's classic masterpiece.
You ever seen that? That's pretty cool.
What's that?
Metropolis.
You've seen Metropolis?
Yeah, have you seen? I saw it in a film class in college. Not to brag, Toby.
No, that's nice. I took a film class in college, and we did it all through crime films.
Oh, boy.
So we didn't get to see Metropolis. I think we saw M. Is that the one? Is that the name of it? With the kid who's like the guy who's like a sex predator. Anyway.
Very on brand, Toby. I mean, not the sex predator thing, but the crime.
The crime thing, crime thing, yeah.
Couldn't get away from it.
I could not. Von Braun becomes head of the German rocket program at the tender age of 20 years old. This leads, of course, to speculation by ancient astronaut theorists that perhaps von Braun was being directed by aliens. And to talk to this theory, we have Nick Pope, David Wilcock, and, of course, your man, Giorgio Tsoukalos.
Love him.
Maybe he drew his inspiration from science fiction. Maybe it came from his own imagination and vision of what the future should be. Or maybe it was inspired by something extraterrestrial.
Some sort of extraterrestrial contact might have happened with Wernher von Braun. Something or someone might have reached him and saw where we needed to go as a civilization and gave him the tools and the insights that he needed to be able to build our way out into space.
Some have suggested that people like Albert Einstein, Tesla, that they've had this extraterrestrial intervention, that they have had access to this abundance of knowledge. And the question has arisen, did Wernher von Braun, was he also one of them? Because the vision he had, the ideas were incredible for their time.
Yeah, you have to look for how they're building their argument. At no point does von Braun say, I got all my inspiration from the stars. So they're really trying to bend over backwards to make it work, including a quote from his father, von Braun's father, who when he was a kid, he was, you know, a bit of a prodigy. And his father described him as, quote, a mystery. And they were like, see, how did he know this stuff? What was the source of all of his wisdom and insight?
I did, and I can't remember exactly where this went, but I did put the quote, some people have suggested, which seems like a classic ancient aliens lead into some profoundly wrong statement.
Yeah.
Let's go to the Nazi stuff, all right? Because this is one of the things that makes von Braun pretty controversial for good reason, is he was working in Germany during the rise of the Nazis, and the way they kind of position it in the episode is that he managed to avoid joining the Nazis until 1937. And then he only did it because that was a way to sort of continue with his science in a way that he wouldn't be able to do if he did not join the Nazi party. Brandon.
Yeah.
You have thoughts and facts?
I really enjoy that Robert Perlman said, quote, he didn't think the Nazi movement was the way to go. That's such a casual way to say he didn't think the Nazi movement was the way to go. He's like, meh, I didn't think I was going to wear shorts today, or, oh, you know, right. I think the espadrille is out. Like, come on, buddy.
Right.
I mean, you know.
Not doing keto.
Yeah. At the time, you know, it was a political movement. I guess you could have thought of it in a more or less fashionable way. But this is an example of the episode has found something that's really interesting, a really interesting person to talk about. And obviously a lot of hay has been made about von Braun over the years, documentaries, books, etc., some of which we'll talk about. You know, so they have to sort of gloss over a lot of the negative stuff in order to, you know, make it seem like he's this great guy who's being driven by these extraterrestrial forces. And if you get too much into the idea of him hemming and hawing about his political allegiances, it sort of makes it seem like, well, maybe you weren't as much the vessel of some kind of superior knowledge as it seems. But that's obviously a much more interesting story. And by the way, kind of the factually accurate one. But they don't get into that. So they sort of have to lightly skim over, like, yeah, he didn't think it was a way to go. I mean, he joined up. And as we'll see, he participated in some things that were pretty horrible. So that's what I think. Yeah, it's like just keeping an eye on where they're kind of whitewashing the legacy of certain unfortunate figures.
Right. And I think that, you know, the fact is that he not only did he kind of join the Nazi party, but he was developing sort of advanced weapons for them, advanced weapons for the time. So it wasn't like he was going along so he could write papers at his university or whatever. Like he joined them and then he was making the V2 rocket.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, he was making advanced ways of killing people to further Germany's war aims.
Yeah. And just to get into the question of what he knew. Again, if you just watch the episode, you'll think, well, he was kept apart from all of the true horrors of the Nazi regime because he was just an egghead working in a lab. He was working in a lab developing rockets and ended up being fired into London. So I don't know how he avoided that. But Michael Neufeld, author wrote a book in 2008 called Von Braun, Dreamer of Space, Engineer of War. And in an interview, the first question that Neufeld is asked is, what did he know? And he says, basically, the problem is that people make it look like Von Braun is someone who didn't want to be in the Third Reich. And he says, quote, but all the evidence I have is that he was quite comfortable with the Nazis in the Third Reich until late in the war. And it was only in the very last year or two of the war, through a combination of his last encounter with Hitler, witnessing concentration camp labor, but above all, his own arrest by the Gestapo, that he became disillusioned about this regime that he was working for. So, okay. He didn't ultimately love what was going on, but you have to have a lot of deniability to assume that everything you're doing is for the good. But, you know, he's patriotic. I mean, he was German. He thought they were doing kind of the right thing.
Yeah, and I think, you know, not to justify or approve of his...
This is not a good way into this statement. Let's see how this goes.
No, I mean, I just think there's, you know, not taking in considerations of politics or whatever, but just basically doing whatever you need to do to advance what you're up to.
Yeah.
And sort of ignoring all that stuff, yeah. I think is something that some people do. But, you know, it's the Nazis. Like,
yeah,
you've really got to have your blinders on not to understand that. And it kind of feels like a lot of, like, some of this, at least the stuff that they put in the episode, which make it sounds like he did it reluctantly and for reasons of science, it seems a little bit like putting the best sheen on it you possibly
sure.
can
yeah.
for what were completely unethical and immoral decisions that he made in order to sort of advance himself and advance his science, I guess. So we get the question, how did Wernher von Braun develop rocketry so quickly to a degree that was so much advanced beyond what anybody else was doing at the time? And there's sort of two possibilities. Was it because of the massive support and resources of the German nation that was put behind his project?
Maybe.
Or was it aliens?
Oh. Well, I guess I see which way this show is going to go, Toby.
Well, it just feels like the massive support and resources has been done to death, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Can you tell me, maybe I missed it. To be honest, part of the time I was watching the episode, I was actually driving across town, and so I was watching it on my phone. Just had it set up on the dashboard. So maybe I missed this part.
That sounds like a good idea.
That's LA, you know, this is how you get things done. But was there ever any point at which we get a sense of how the aliens are communicating this to him? Is it telepathic? Are they sending him, you know, care packages with technical diagrams? Was any of that in there?
I do not believe so. No, I think it was happening.
Fair enough.
We can deduce it happened, and just the fact that it happened means that we don't have to worry about how. To a certain extent. To another extent, they do try and draw some lines. And so you go back before von Braun was even a Nazi to 1935, where the Annenerbe, which was a special group. I mean, it's kind of like what was in the first Indiana Jones movie.
Very Indiana.
That was
Jones.
Kind of the inspiration yeah. Yeah. is that they research sort of the cultural and historical roots of Germany, but not just Germany, but sort of Aryanism. So it's a way, like, Hitler wanted to be able to find some historical justification for his belief in sort of the master race. But that also involved looking for sort of cultist objects. But they're doing most of it in Europe. They briefly touch on this story about a UFO that supposedly crashed in Poland.
Mm-hmm.
A multicolored orb of light was seen in the sky in 1937 in southwestern Poland. And by all accounts, this was a UFO sighting, but it's a lot more than that. This orb actually crashed into the ground.
They sort of speculate, as Ancient Aliens often does, about whether the Annenerbe, like, went there and found alien tech
mm-hmm.
that they brought back to Wernher von Braun. And by reverse engineering this tech, that allowed for the fast growth of German rocketry. So here we get a little bit more on safe Ancient Aliens ground, in that you've got UFOs that might have happened. You've got strange people looking into sort of esoteric things like Ark of the Covenant. This feels more like...
Mm-hmm.
solid Ancient Aliens territory.
And the idea that they have really mixed their thesis. Either von Braun was gifted, was touched from an early age, and he was headed this way because he was interested in sci-fi and space and all that from an early age. So you would say, okay, so their argument is that somehow these guys have been communicating with them over the years. But then later on, now they're saying, oh no, there was just this accidentally crashed UFO. Somebody screwed up in space, took a wrong turn, smashed into Poland. And that's how they got their leaps forward, was to reverse engineer the tech. Which is it, Toby?
It's both and.
Fair enough.
Both and. Yeah, now that you mention it, I don't really know what the whole growing up with sort of utopian alien pulp. That seems like that would argue against the ancient aliens. But what can we do? It's just a lot of information. Some of it right, some of it not. Then they go on and claim that the Nazis developed anti-gravity powered saucers, which again, I don't know if you found any evidence for this, but it does not seem to be true. And then based on this sort of spurious claim, ask whether this was a reverse engineered UFO.
Yeah. Is that Die Glocke, which is German for the bell?
The bell?
Yeah.
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 It's a metallic bell about 9 feet in diameter with many mysterious properties. Scientists who have looked at this and the recollections of its appearance and its usage suggest that it had anti-gravitational properties.
We have to legitimately consider that the German scientists were at the root of all this, and that their transferred technology is exactly what is now being used in advanced so-called alien reproduction vehicles built by our own military-industrial complex.
I've certainly heard this before, that there was this rumored, I mean, that's just the greatest pop culture image of the 20th century for a certain kind of kid, I guess. It's like, wait, a Nazi UFO? I mean, that's...
Yeah.
That reminds me, you know, they have to pad their episodes. They've got a lot of historical footage that they can include, obviously, photos of Von Braun and this sort of thing. And then, you know, as is typically the case, they do some recreations, some animations. In this case, there were two that I appreciated. One was having the recreations of like Nazis in meeting rooms. And just that idea of like, you know, your production budget over there at Ancient Aliens is like, oh, the line item is like, $10,000 for Nazi uniforms and flags. You know, some production designer has to go like find that stuff and be like, all right, we're going to have to like press the Nazi pants before they shoot this scene.
Nazi pants.
Well, you know, I mean, that's what I want. So Ancient Aliens producers, anyone who's worked on the show, if you've got access to the budgets for these episodes, I'd love to see how the budget breaks down. And the other thing is Die Glocke, which is the bell. They show it flying. And the way they show it flying is it sort of looks occult. It looks like it's in the middle of an oracle or something. It's this bell-looking vehicle that's flying, and it's in this sort of stone ring in kind of a dark space. And the stone ring is, I guess, supposed to be like this launch pad or whatever. But anyway, it's chained to it. So the ship is sort of like bouncing around in this animation. Yeah. But they really seem to emphasize the idea that like it's chained. It wants to get away. It looks very much like an 80s German metal band's album cover, you know?
What, like the Scorpions?
Just like the Scorpions, yeah.
Or UFO.
Mm-hmm. Scorpions are working for the other guys. They were working for the CIA.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah.
Yeah, in the 30s, we didn't have a handle on anti-gravity as well, so I guess you had to chain things down. Mm-hmm. It's like letting a bull out of the chute at the rodeo.
That's exactly right. There were Nazi rodeo clowns that had to
exactly
keep the spaceship from getting out of control.
All right, so then we get to back to something that resembles actual history with Operation Paperclip. I think really focus on the real question. Like, there's been a lot of books and stuff about sort of the moral quandaries and compromises that were made in order to bring these scientists who are Nazis to America to work on American programs. Reasons why those Nazi scientists decided to come to the United States instead of going to Russia or, you know, Latin America or something.
Brazil. Boys of Brazil.
Yeah, boys of Brazil. But that's not really the big question, which they understand. The big question is, did these German scientists bring extraterrestrial knowledge to the United States?
Right.
And I think that it's a question for which there are probably no answers.
Well, I mean, certainly the episode from here on out, I won't say approaches the answer. and I won't even really say dances around the answer, but certainly flirts with the idea of thinking about what an answer might potentially look like through a series of very open-ended questions.
Yes.
Let's talk about Operation Paperclip a little bit. Because of all of the interesting pivots in American history, least recent American history, Operation Paperclip is a hell of a one. Because as you might accidentally learn from this episode, we really did import a lot of Nazi scientists into the U.S. and they really did jumpstart NASA and get us to the moon. So, you know, everybody focuses on Wernher von Braun. He was the most high-profile member of the SS that was working on the rocket program. But there were all these others. There were, I think, 130 or something other scientists and engineers who were brought to the U.S. after the war ended, right? And so the whole idea was there were all of these dossiers that the government had on all of these figures working for the Nazi party at various levels, right? And so it's like, what are you going to do with them? Some of them we have to put on trial. Are there any of them who are useful to us? And so the whole idea was like, put a paperclip on the folder of the ones that we think would be useful to us. Those are the ones we're going to bring over. And so 130 scientists, engineers get the nod, of which, of course, Wernher von Braun is the most famous one. But, you know, the question of like who these guys really were is, you know, just to take one example of what these guys knew. Von Braun supposedly had seen these caves where a lot of these concentration camp prisoners were working as slave labor to build the rockets for the rocket program. But there were other guys. There was a guy named Arthur Rudolph, and he was the chief engineer of the V2 rocket factory at a place called Peenemünde. And so he was heading this thing up. And in the last couple of years of the war, you know, you have thousands of people working as slaves that were being pulled over from concentration camp nearby. And they're working in these atrocious conditions. They're deep in these mines. The air quality is terrible. It's very humid, so the people are developing lung conditions. They're making beds out of straw on the rock. They've built bunk beds. So people are dying right and left. It's very bad. But apparently there was a spate of failures of these rockets. They kept failing, and the Nazis were like, why are these rockets crapping out? Turns out the prisoners were able to sabotage them during production. And so here's something that I read. Was all it took was a screw left loose, a bad weld, an incomplete circuit connection. Prisoners even urinated on electrical components, and a rocket would fail. So they're doing this. And so here's this guy, Rudolph, who's trying to basically quality control it. And they do an investigation. They find these 12 prisoners that they want to make an example of. So they hang them in the middle of these caves where the rockets are being developed. 11 of these guys die immediately. One guy is just left up there choking. Rudolph says, leave him up there. Leave him up there all day. We want two shifts to come through and see what happens if you push back against us, if you try and screw up our program. So that's Rudolph. What happens to him? Well, he's one of those engineers that's brought to the U.S. under Operation Paperclip. He works at the White Sands Proving Ground, ends up working at NASA, ends up being the program director for the Saturn V rocket, right? The one that took everybody up into space and then eventually to the moon. And so anyway, he ends up retiring. He's living in California. And in 1984, this past catches up with him, and he has to leave the U.S. to avoid a war crimes trial. Now, you might think, what is the source for this? The source for all this information that I got is from the White Sands Missile Base Museum website. Even they're like, yeah, we had some shitty people working here. I mean, come on, Toby. Get it together. That's my takeaway. Get it together, Toby.
Yeah, you're going to pin this on me?
Yeah. I don't know where you were.
Yeah, that's true.
You have a lot of paper clips.
I do have a lot of paper clips. They're shaped like cows, though.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a little, this doesn't make for good podcasting, but it's a UFO magnet that picks up cow-shaped paper clips.
That's cool.
It's a dark operation that we engaged in of making, you know, judgments about how much we're going to hold people responsible for, you know, crimes against humanity if they can provide us with engineering know-how to achieve certain national goals that we have. And the decision was made that we would not hold them accountable in this case until, you know, long after his actual value was gone. And then it was like, oh, okay, well, now we can we can prosecute him
right
now that he's old and he's not working on these things anymore. If this was a World War II podcast we were doing, I mean, I think we could like really dive into a bunch of other sort of morally complicit things that our government did sort of both during World War II and after World War II, that while we were fighting against the Germans and anti-Nazi and stuff, there were compromises that we made and there were things that we weren't willing to do, such as receive a boat of Jewish refugees and allow them to dock. But again, this isn't the kind of stuff that Ancient Aliens is going to spend a whole lot of time focused on, because again, the real story here is, did they bring ET knowledge to the US? And then what did we do with that ET knowledge? If, as ancient astronaut theorists believe, they did bring over this ET knowledge, to what use did we put it? And as you mentioned earlier, some of it was taking us to the moon, a stunning achievement, which, again, you can ask the question, was this made by the use of advanced physics? Like seriously, like even just like pencil on paper type stuff, because, and I don't know if this is true, but there was always that meme back in the early days of cell phones that there was more computer power in a consumer cell phone than there was in the entire original moon landing. So this is all just like calculations that were done by people to make it work. And so was it this, or again, was it extraterrestrial knowledge?
Yeah.
Just leaving it hanging.
Yeah, I was really puzzled by the episode positing that the only way Von Braun could have known about things like orbital trajectory and the gravitational pull of the moon and all that stuff is from ancient alien technology. How would they know how to do that? It's like, well, you find this thing where you have a certain kind of math or physics that is extremely advanced in that most people don't know how to get a rocket out of Earth's orbit, but it's just a modification of other kinds of physics that have been around for, you know, 500, 600, 1,000 years. But, you know, the show doesn't investigate that. It's just like, basically their thesis is, this has never been done before and it's really hard. Therefore, it must be impossible for where we're at. So we needed help from outside. That's, again, the refrain they come back to over and over again. It could be the pyramids. It could be escape velocity, but it's always math-based. It's like a show that's really neurotic about the influence of math on the human race and very distrustful of it. Like, how in the hell did we do this?
My buddy Tim does the same kind of physics, like trying to find where things that fall out of Earth orbit, where they may land, and distribution of like, I think it was like when meteor showers hit the moon, like how the meteors will be distributed and stuff. So, you know, it's similar types of physics where you're working with gravity and momentum and all these kinds of things and making extremely accurate predictions about where things will end up. And that was essentially a lot of the physics that was necessary for this. So again, you know, reducing like sort of human ingenuity to alien influence.
Yeah.
An ancient alien's specialty.
Yeah. You can sort of see that go across the board too. Future episodes could be Virginia Woolf. How did she come up with stream of consciousness writing? How did she have such access to the inner workings of the human mind? Did she come up with it on her own? Or did aliens have something to do with it? Or Julia Child. How did this American housewife become a master French chef? Was it from studying the techniques? Or was there something more going on? And then, you know, they have a reenactment of like somebody playing Julia Child and she goes out into her suburban backyard and there's like a crashed UFO and all of this like advanced chef technology spills out.
Right.
It's like, ah.
Steak au poivre.
Yeah.
Yeah. Phil Jackson with the with the triangle offense.
Yeah. There you go.
There's no way humans could imagine that.
Amazing.
Yeah. Well, season 35 of Ancient Aliens will probably start diving into individual innovators and how they actually got it from ETs. I am kind of intrigued by the idea that aliens would be experts in French cuisine.
Yeah. Physics. That's just physics too, Toby, when it comes right down to it.
Yeah, that's true. What is it? Salt, fat, heat, and something else.
Love.
That's not how I remember it, but
you You know, Toby, after the successful moon landing, there's this comedian named Tom Lehrer who debuted this very famous piano song, comedy song called Wernher von Braun in, you know, 1969. And it's pretty incredible. He basically just tears von Braun a new one about being a Nazi and, you know, knowing that he was making orphans and cripples in London, but being okay with it. It's a real wild piece of satire.
Gather round while I sing you of Wernher von Braun, a man whose allegiance is ruled by expedience. Call him a Nazi, he won't even frown. Nazi schmatzi, says Wernher von Braun. Don't say that he's hypocritical, say rather that he's apolitical. Once the rockets are up, who cares where they come down? That's not my department, says Wernher von Braun.
So we have a quick thing about von Braun talking about colonies in space, and then it's asked, was he talking about this because he knew that there were already some that existed? People are always fucking talking about colonies in space. I'm sure it was in those pulps that he was reading in Germany in the 20s. You know, Ray Bradbury wrote the Martian Chronicles. I mean, that's just like by ancient alien standards, this just seems kind of ridiculous. But then we get to a more intriguing thing, which is when we landed on the moon, we left some things. We left an olive branch and a peace message from 78 world leaders on the moon.
Yeah. The olive branch was like a gold pin in the shape of an olive branch. And then the message was, it looked like messages written on a microchip. They show it compared to a half dollar or something.
Yeah, and it's dependent upon alien technology being able to extract that information, much less understand what the fuck it meant. But it does bring up the question, did we expect someone to find them? Or as ancient aliens would say, when you find out this information, you must ask yourself, did we expect someone to find them?
Yeah.
My answer is no. I think it's just one of those nice little symbolic things that one does. Thoughts on this?
I guess I'd say some ancient astronaut theorists suggest that von Braun was expecting to find more on the moon. He may have known something was up, so that's why he sent that message. Now, no mention, Toby, of the Voyager missions from the late 70s that were sent out to take pictures of the planets. That was a program that was headed up by Carl Sagan. And in addition to being now the longest lasting and furthest out science mission in history, at least one of them has left the solar system. But anyway, one of the great aspects of that was the Golden Record, which was this record that had all of this stuff imprinted on it, had images of Earth, had a bunch of music, Chuck Berry and
Beethoven,
yeah. And then messages like they're talking about here from world leaders and greetings in all these languages. That Sagan was like, it's a nice gesture. If someone happens across this spacecraft in years to come, maybe they'll be able to decode it and figure out what we're saying. But they're not bringing that up. Like here you see NASA has this concerted effort to try and reach out to somebody. Sagan himself was like, the next closest star system this thing's going to reach is like 40,000 years away. So he's like, it's not really going to matter for us necessarily, but it's a nice gesture. Toby, it's a nice gesture. You put out milk and cookies for Santa, but that doesn't mean you really think that asshole's coming down the chimney. It's just a gesture.
It's symbolic. I mean, it's the same as they put a flag up there. It's not because we think the moon is American.
Well, Toby.
Or maybe we do. I don't know.
That may be a little more literal.
But that's all complicated, Brandon, by the Apollo 17 mission.
Tell me about it.
Which you may already know this, but ancient astronauts theorists believe that we had discovered evidence of ETs on the moon and that Apollo 17 was actually a technological recovery mission. So then they have this really weird thing, and they're running this audio of radio communication, and they're running it over footage of astronauts kind of bouncing around the moon. But there's no real indication if the two are related.
Mm-hmm.
Like, is this the actual conversations that these astronauts are having at the time? Or is this a conversation astronauts are having at a different time that they're putting over this footage? Or is this completely made up conversation that they're putting over this footage? it's a little bit unclear what is going on. But they bring up this idea that at Shorty Crater, that there are objects that to the naked eye look like rocks. Mm-hmm. But to an engineer, and I might add a trained engineer, they're clearly mechanisms. And so they bring up this little conspiracy thing about how they're filming everything that's going on with these astronauts. But at one point, they walk off to this area. And instead of following with the camera where they're going, they turn the camera so it's static in the other direction. And it doesn't pick them up again until they've returned.
Yeah.
Which, again, when you hear about this, you are absolutely forced to ask yourself the question, what were they recovering?
Forced at gunpoint to say, why weren't they filming that?
Yeah.
I mean, you're not forced under pain of death to ask, did they need to film it if they were dealing with UFO stuff? Like, no one was obligating them to. It's not like NASA was going to go into this top secret operation and be like, I mean, we have to film. Toby, we have to film something. But well, we could point it a different way. I mean, there's plenty of cool stuff to film on the surface of the moon. Just don't, whatever you do, film all that alien wreckage, especially the helmet that's buried in the sand.
Yes, you brought up a very intriguing thing, which is there's a rock in Shorty Crater that looks a little bit like a metallic human head from the particular angle in which this photo that we're looking at makes it look. And then I can't remember who it is, but some guy says, you come to the realization that you are looking at the metallic head of a humanoid robot.
Humanoid appearing robot.
Did he say humanoid appearing?
A humanoid appearing robot.
Found that the object appears metallic.
The most intriguing thing is that on the upper part of the mouth, there was a bright, distinct red stripe painted across it, and it glowed and shone as if it were metallic. You then come to the realization that what you're probably looking at is the head of a humanoid appearing robot, the leftovers of an explosion that damaged and destroyed a bunch of mechanical stuff.
Incredible if true.
Yeah. But even as you're watching them, like, zoom in and resolve this image and zoom in and, like, color over it, it's like, well, you're clearly, like, adding to this thing to make it look like basically a human skull. And then they have to add this red strip so that when he says, and then you can see this red strip, which you can't see this red strip, until they add a red strip on the front. And it glistens like metal or something like this. I mean, you really see just in that few seconds, like, how hard people have to work to see things in the clouds. It's called pareidolia, and it's a normal human thing where we just happen to, because of our evolutionary history, we're wired to see faces everywhere because faces are extremely important to our early ancestors. Toby, you need to know what a person's face is doing so that you can determine if they're a threat or if they're a friend or whatever. So a whole big apparatus in our brain is dedicated to figuring out what the hell faces mean. The consequence of that is that we see fucking faces everywhere. And so you have stuff like this. Later on, we'll talk about the same thing happens when we go to Mars. There's a big face on Mars that everybody's quacking on about for years and years. But it's like, yeah, I guess it certainly could look like that, but it also could look like not that. So calling it a humanoid appearing robot, I think, is something, Toby, of a stretch.
You feel like it's a stretch? It's like when I see faces in my toast.
Oh, God.
Yeah, it's probably a little bit of a stretch. The other thing is, like, you see these things, like, I haven't seen it so much on Mars, I mean on the moon, but on Mars, like, they'll be like, it's clearly a pyramid. And then they show, like, a different angle of the same thing, and it's just clearly not a pyramid. Yeah. It's just the way the shadows happen to fall from the angle in which that photo was taken and stuff. So drawing conclusions from a single photograph of a landscape, it's not a great way of going about your business, because there's a lot of things that look strange because of shadows and angles. So having at least two shots from different angles is probably helpful in determining whether that actually was the metallic head of a humanoid seeming robot.
Humanoid appearing robot. It didn't seem, it appeared to.
Appeared.
To be a humanoid robot.
Yes, and it got scattered in a lab explosion in Shorty Crater, of which there is no other evidence.
Yeah. Von Braun, we're coming around to the end of his career. Do we want to go back and talk about his Disney years?
We can.
I mean, there's not a whole lot to say other than you know, Disney was a fascinating dude for a lot of reasons, as we mentioned. And he and Von Braun worked together to do these documentaries about, like, what life in space would look like. How do you get to the moon? This was, like, in the 50s. So, you know, part of what's fascinating about it is Disney was such a visionary for just doing television, right? He was the guy who basically invented the DVD extra. You know, he got this show in the 50s called Disneyland, and he's like, he's at the time doing his movies, and he wants to build this theme park in California. And he realizes all of this stuff is content. He's like, wait, we're making 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. We can film the behind-the-scenes stuff, the making of, and do interviews with Kirk Douglas and all these people, and we can put that together and make that an episode of Disneyland. So not only is the movie content, but the making of the movie is content, and it also functions as publicity for the thing. So he really created the modern entertainment apparatus around the time that he was working with Von Braun. Now I ask you, Toby, for the love of God, I ask you, how did Disney come up with all these great ideas? On his own?
That seems clear that that cannot be the case. And I do believe that aliens had DVD technology before us. Therefore, we're able to tell him about the director's cuts and the add-ons and all that stuff. So that most likely is the...
Yeah. We keep coming back to this idea that Disney was... Or rather, I keep coming back to this idea that Disney was influenced by possibly ancient astronauts, according to an ancient astronaut theorist who is me. Anyway, it's an interesting thing, and I think the visuals were cool of the stuff that Von Braun was working on in the documentary. You know, it looks like Black Hole or something. It looks like one of those old-timey movies. Yeah. Pretty cool-looking stuff, though.
God, Black Hole. I saw that in the theater.
Boring movie.
That was terrible. Even when I was 8 or something.
Yeah, it's not great. But all of which is to say that it's really interesting to just remember that, in fact, there was a time in American history when the most beloved purveyor of children's entertainment worked with one of the most well-regarded Nazi scientists. That really happened. They made TV shows together, and people watched them, and they're like, these guys, amazing. I mean,
these fucking guys.
We don't have that anymore. Elon Musk wishes he was one or both of them.
Who would be, who's our
modern
Walt Disney?
Zuckerberg? I mean,
oh, come on.
Well, I mean, I don't like it, Toby, but I'm just saying, who's an innovator for interpersonal communication?
Yeah, but is he a personality? I feel like Walt Disney was kind of a personality.
I will say that Zuck is now trying to be a personality. He's grown his hair out, so he's got a cool mullet, and he's wearing a gold chain now. So
he's a little bit of a badass. Mm-hmm. All right, I think we've already talked too much about Mark Zuckerberg. So they probably didn't bring artifacts from the moon. We can just dispose of that one. So we go into the end where clearly they have to fill up a little bit more time. So we get a conspiracy theorist favorite, Bohemian Grove, which is, it's basically a club of very wealthy and powerful people. Supposedly Wernher von Braun was part of it.
This was after he retired from NASA, the last mission, the one that found the humanoid appearing robot. Yeah, the show says in 72, he left. So after that mission, he leaves and they say, isn't it a little weird that he's just sneaking off? And also, isn't it suspicious that after he retired, he grew a beard, as is clearly depicted in one of the photos? And then he goes and hooks up with Bohemian Grove. Mm-hmm.
It's all very strange and ET-like. Supposedly, according to them, rumors that Bohemian Grove people have formed a breakaway civilization that has been in contact, has agreements with a variety of extraterrestrial races.
Mm-hmm. It is rumored that some members of the Bohemian Club also belong to private groups called breakaway civilizations that have developed advanced technologies independent of world governments.
I've had insiders that have told me that they worked in this space program, that we do have a breakaway civilization, that it's extremely advanced, that we already have diplomatic relationships with a variety of extraterrestrial species and cultures.
Brandon, what evidence do they use to support this outlandish claim?
Well, other than the animation of the space station that looks fancy, where presumably all the rich people live, a la that movie Elysian, I guess you have the fact that these guys are all rich and they all get together in a Grove in California called Bohemian Grove, and they do weird rituals, weird rich guy rituals, where there's like a talking owl. This is for real. They're really not a talking owl, but a PA system that someone talks through, and it's in the shape of an owl.
Oh, it's not an actual owl that talks.
I don't think so. No, I think it's a, right. It's a whatever.
So disappointing. All right.
I liked it. Yeah. That in the end of this, they, you know, I'm always curious about what are the live wires that ancient aliens won't touch in order to avoid alienating their viewership. So you're trying to like, you know, is this kind of crypto-fascist? Is it sort of really conservative? Is it Christian? There's all these things that in some ways, if you think about it, ancient aliens is kind of transgressive because they're sort of like, they don't go so far as to say, what if Jesus is an alien? But they are essentially saying like, what if all gods everywhere were really just beings from space? So that's interesting to me. And in this case, I feel like the third rail that they touched is sort of a critique of capitalism a little bit, critique of high net worth individuals who are getting together and doing some shady things. It's a little bit of like creating some class conflict. These guys are up there in their space stations and their breakaway civilizations. And you're just down here watching Disney movies like an asshole.
I think it's all, you know, there's always been this sort of nexus between real out there conspiracy theorists, you know, sort of Illuminati, Bohemian Grove, Trilateral Commission, that kind of stuff. And then people who are into UFOs. So it's like interesting that they bring it up and then they don't really go into it too much, but they definitely do sort of give it some credence without digging too deep.
Yeah.
It seems unlikely that they have a breakaway civilization that has been in contact with a variety of ETs, but there you go.
Mm-hmm. We're not rich enough to get into it. If any of our listeners are connected to Bohemian Grove, we'd appreciate you sending us any documentation about the truth or falsity of a talking owl, of breakaway civilizations. Dobby, throw in here. What else do we want while we're asking?
Those seem like the two biggies to me.
I guess so. Sandwich, maybe? I don't know. It's about that time.
Sandwich, yeah. It's getting there. So this kind of ends in the way they often do with sort of a whole bunch of questions and then talk about intelligently designed artifacts and structures on both the moon and Mars. They kind of throw out that there's no question that they aren't natural. They must be made by some kind of human or non-human intelligence. And then we're out of there.
Yeah. We come back to Von Braun, who dies young. He has cancer. 4 years cancer, and then he dies at 65. And, you know, their big gotcha is on his tombstone, Toby, there was no epitaph.
Oh, yeah. Just the Bible verse.
Psalm 19:1. It doesn't say what the epitaph is, but I will say here for you. I mean, they do say in the show, but it doesn't say it on the tombstone. But the idea is like there's some kind of mystery. Like, this was a man who had done so much and he didn't leave a message. What is that about? Psalms 19:1.
You have to go and look it up.
Yeah, well, Psalms 19:1, I'll do the work for you. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament sheweth his handiwork. I believe that's the King James Version, that sheweth his handiwork. So, I don't know.
Can you define sheweth?
Showed.
Oh.
Yeah. It's just saying, you know, space is cool. It's evidence of God showing his work, you know. Like, oh, look, there it is. Yeah. He did a good job. I also like the sudden and sort of delightful appearance of former President Barack Obama, who they introduce in 2015, presumably right around the time this episode was originally airing, coming in and announcing one of the Mars missions. And, you know, just like after all of this stuff with Nazis and aliens and weird cults, then here's Obama, this familiar guy talking in his folksy way. Let's get up there, everybody.
And that's actually kind of uplifting, like if you're into the space program, having these sort of lofty goals of what you're going to try and achieve,
yeah,
with or without extraterrestrial assistance.
Yeah. I mean, again, strip away all the bullshit of this episode, and what you have is a really fascinating narrative of how so much progress is built on moral compromises and the price that we are willing to pay to compete with other nations or to push our own goals forward. And how, you know, that can be embodied in a single person who had to make these decisions and was certainly guided by something, not necessarily aliens, but ambition, genius, drive, whatever it is.
Yep.
And, you know, you're willing to turn a blind eye to some of those things in order to get things done, Toby.
And I guess that's sort of the sort of ultimate failing of this episode in particular, but in a lot of episodes is sort of burying what's actually interesting and what you can actually learn from in a whole freaking steaming heap of alien influence and other typical ancient astronaut ridiculousness.
Yeah.
This is not a great episode in my opinion. And I was trying to think, like, why does this suck more than other ones do? And I think part of it is that it's just so much more speculation of the how could they possibly do this without actually having anything that's particularly unknown to show you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's more like here are these things that you know about. How could they possibly have made that happen? It must have been aliens. Whereas most of the other shows are at least taking things that are somewhat unfamiliar to you and sort of making a case, like, based on, you know, quote unquote evidence that this somehow aliens had something to do here.
Well, and I think it suffers too from something that you might know from your college crime film class, an orgy of evidence, right? Like the ancient alien stuff, when you're dealing with the pyramids or whatever, it's like, well, there's not a lot of documentation around that time. So you can go around and make claims about what this or that hieroglyph is. But in this case, there's tons of documentation. There's tons of film, tons of letters. So there's all kinds of stuff that sort of complicate your argument. And, you know, what you're seeing is the holes where it's like, well, we don't really have any evidence that this thing crashed in Poland, but we've got tons of photos of Von Braun running around with the Nazis, looking happy with the Nazis, working on the space program, all that stuff. So again, that's the naturally more interesting thing, but this is the problem they're going to run into when they're doing things that are closer to now. Orgy of evidence, Toby. That's the real crime of this episode.
That is a nice mental picture.
Well, Toby, I feel like we have adequately sheweth our handiwork on this episode.
Yeah.
This is More Like Ancient Phalians. I'm Brandon R. Reynolds.
And I'm Toby Ball.
More Like Ancient Phalians is produced by Heather Eagle Ears Wilson. And our beautiful music is by Nathan Reedy.
Next time, did aliens create half-human, half-animal hybrids depicted in ancient cultures? Are ancient gods really aliens? How many people walking around right now are actually human-alien hybrids? We're talking about Project Hybrid. That's season 14, episode 10. See you then.